Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. Welcome to the Hoban Minute.
Today, Bob and I are talking with California cannabis power hitter, Graham Farrar, president of the Glasshouse Group. Graham, thanks for taking some time to be with us here today.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me, guys. Happy to be here.
Well, we've been awaiting this conversation, and we've been eager to talk to you because we know you have a lot going on, and you've been a prolific figure out in the California cannabis space. And before we talk about all of the things that you have your hands in with the growth of the California cannabis industry, give us a little bit of your background in the tech space. Since you have such a varied and storied history, what do our listeners need to know about you to kind of understand the perspective and the acumen that you bring to the cannabis space?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you're probably giving me more credit than I deserve there, but if I was going to put it up in a nutshell, I'd say I'm a tech guy by experience, but a cannabis lover by passion. I've got a lot of experience doing things that people have no experience doing. That's probably the common thread that unites what I've done on the business side. And by that, I mean, I started my career at a company called software.com. This was back in 1995, which probably is, you know, before a lot of people even remember the internet, but we were building a company that was basically a digital post office, right? So we made the software that ran email before most people realized they were going to have an email address. So this is back when, if you weren't in the government or you weren't at a university, email was a new thing. But as that transition happened, you know, you got your first ISP account, you're dialing up with your modem and your email set somewhere before you could download it. We made that software that did it. So we took that company public in 99. It was the right time to be going public. You know, $200 a share. Don Listland, who was the number two at Cisco, came over to be our CEO. It was a really great time, a lot of fun. And then from there, I took a break and I bought a sailboat and I sailed for 2 years from Santa Barbara, which is my hometown, down to New Zealand. Came back. I left with my girlfriend and came back to get married. And I called up John McFarland, who's the CEO of software.com, and said, "Hey, I need help. Otherwise, I'm going to get stuck picking out centerpieces for wedding arrangements. What are you doing?" And he said, "Me and, you know, four other guys have an idea for this thing that would eventually become Sonos." So again, back in the beginning, back before people had digital music, we sat down and started coming up with how to do, you know, an iPod for the home, so to speak. So I was lucky enough to be one of the original guys over at Sonos. That went public a couple of years ago. 15 years later, still, I think, the best product in the category. And all through that time, though, I was a cannabis lover, right? And that meant growing it in my closet. That meant, you know, playing around in garages. It just meant I thought the world was better with cannabis in it. I enjoyed consuming it. I thought the technology approach and the plants and all that was really fun. So I started a company making apps for kids, again, right when apps came out, and started a company that made fertilizer, nutrients, and growing systems for growers. And through that, realized that the best people in cannabis actually didn't really know what they were doing either. And a lot of the experience that I gleaned over the last 25 years as a hobbyist was actually pretty relevant and at the forefront of things. So put that together with a view on systems and technology and the love of cannabis and being in the right climate of Santa Barbara, you know, the serendipity is kind of almost so good. It's hard to believe it's real, but, you know, it all came together to launch into what would become Glasshouse Farms.
Well, and it's always good to sort of succeed at a very high level in your hometown, or at least with roots there. But I want to talk about some of the parallels between your tech experience and the cannabis experience from a commercial perspective. But before I get there, Santa Barbara to New Zealand, holy smokes. Can you tell us a tumultuous tale, if you will? Tell us something that would be interesting that, you know, something horrible that happened, or something that was that made you grit your teeth really hard and pray to whomever.
Yeah, so I mean, horrible on a boat in the middle of the Pacific is a kind of a different scale of horrible. So luckily, nothing horrible happened. There were certainly a few harrowing tales out there. The first one that comes to mind is it's about 7 days sail from Fiji to New Zealand, and typically that's a longer period of time than you can get an accurate weather forecast for. So you watch the weather and you set out and you know kind of what's going to happen the next 3 days, and then the next four you get what you get. And what we got was about 45 knot wind, 25 foot seas. It was all right on the nose. We were right into it, basically launching the boat wave after wave, rocking back and forth, there was one place on the entire boat that you could lay down to sleep that you wouldn't get, you know, tossed in the air. So we were four of us on the boat at that time for the crossing. This is a 46-foot sailboat for context. So we were all basically time sharing this one spot on the boat to try and do sleep, to sleep. And you're sailing 24 hours a day. So you're doing, you know, 4-hour watches during the day and 2-hour watches at night. And it's like having a baby. You're never fully rested. And my, my girlfriend, now wife, who was with us, had prepared, you know, the meals in advance. The boat was rocking so hard that we were unable, we couldn't cook any of them. So here we are 7 days in, 24 hours a day, leaping off of waves, hoping the mast didn't break, fighting for a single spot to sleep, and all basically eating Triscuits and cheese because the boat was moving around too much to cook. And then we pulled into North Harbor there in the North Island, and in a period of about 15 minutes, went from the roughest thing you could imagine to dead placid, flat calm, pulled into the harbor, and half hour later, we had a beer in our hand and forgot it all happened and just enjoyed New Zealand.
Well, I look forward to hearing more of those tales over a beer someday soon. But let's talk a little bit about and transition into your tech experience and how that prepared you for, you know, entry into the commercial cannabis space. Because the tech industry has been known in many ways to have sort of these quick flashes in the pan, if you will. Something that goes out and makes a big splash, maybe creates a liquidity event for its founders, but then things tend to taper off oftentimes, although the good companies, Sonos being one of them, of course, they're around to stay and they've made their imprint. The cannabis industry is no different. So many folks in the cannabis industry went out, raised a bunch of money, went public so that they could create that liquidity event or so forth and so on. And then there's not much to say after that. How did working in the tech space prepare you to build what you've built thus far, and I know it's a team effort, but what you lead thus far in the cannabis space so that it is built to last?
So, you know, I think one of the primary things that I learned in tech, and I would credit John McFarland, who's the CEO of both Software.com and Sonos, for the lesson was, if you focus on the long term and you build a good business, everything is an option, right? And he had amazingly, he's kind of a, I don't know what he is, you know, it kind of reminds me of, I think the Chinese, frankly, are good at this, right? They're not thinking about tomorrow. They're thinking about, you know, generations ahead and what is the long term look like? And John thinks the same way, right? And especially in internet days, we all wanted liquidity and we all saw what was going on and we all saw, you know, pets.com and, you know, et cetera, that were, you know, exploding, right? Well, we had a business that actually was making money, that was truly generating revenue. And here we were, like, you know, no one had heard about us. And that was because John had always focused on build a solid business and everything will be an option, right? You don't build it to go public. You don't build it to be a flash in the pan, as you said. You build a solid foundation and then you can do whatever makes the most sense and whatever creates the most value for shareholders and employees, et cetera. And I think the same thing applies to cannabis, right? There's a lot of flash. There's a lot of smoke and mirrors out there. And, you know, with Glasshouse, it's a new name for a lot of people because we've just, you know, we started heads down being a wholesale supplier and just running a farm when people thought farms weren't flashy and trying to get as, you know, best quality, consistency, and efficiency that we could, and then converted that into a brand. And then people started to see it. They're really only California because that we're a California-focused company. And then it's just kind of now as we're moving towards, you know, the public markets and the broader, you know, broader investment base out there outside of California and starting to think about interstate commerce, that the name is kind of getting out and people think it's new, but then they look and they realize, oh, these guys have been doing this for over half a decade and they've got positive EBITDA and they've got real revenue and it grows over time and they've expanded and, you know, converted multiple farms and they've grown and, you know, tripled in size 3 times. And then it just always reminded me that make a solid business, do the best you can, be honest. You know, admit when you make a mistake, say, tell people how you're going to fix it, then go do what you said. And I think that worked everywhere, including cannabis, where it maybe is more rare than other industries.
Well, I think what maybe our listeners don't always understand is that one of the reasons that cannabis companies tend to try to go public or avail themselves of public markets in the early stages versus, as you described, building a solid business that has a good foundation and can participate in an industry for the foreseeable future is because there's not a lot of access to capital in the cannabis space from traditional sources, from institutional sources. So the way that many cannabis companies have tried to avail themselves of capital for scaling and otherwise is to go to the public markets. Can you comment on that too, in that distinction? Because it's counterintuitive to so many people that have been involved in companies that have gone public in other sectors.
So, I mean, and this is the challenge and the opportunity, I think, for cannabis, right? The capital dislocation, as far as I know, it's really hard to find other places where you see this kind of capital dislocation. Again, and to compare it to tech, right? Like, you build something and you get funding to build it, to see if your idea works. And people are willing to do that, right? Like, you know, if you think about some of the early .com things, right? Like, they put money. You know, you can find examples of $1 billion raised on a slide deck. Okay, there's an idea. Now, you take that compared to cannabis, which we know people want. We know the market's measured in the billions and probably hundreds of billions. We know people have been buying cannabis since the price was going to jail. You know it's a market. You have a solution, and yet you live in a world where raising the money to do something that's basically right in front of you is can be next to impossible, right? So we were really lucky in that we had a track record and a team and people who believed in us so that we could do things that are frankly very hard, right? Like when you buy a farm of cannabis, you don't get to get a mortgage. You're not putting 20% down and getting a 5% loan or whatever, right? We bought a $10 million farm for $10 million, right? In cash. And then we had to take what turned out to be about 34 months to get that farm licensed before we could even put a cannabis plant in it, right? Like, that's not the way the world works. The opportunity side is, if it wasn't like that, then a group like us, you know, would probably get their butt kicked by a Monsanto or a Cargill or a ConAgra or, you know, somebody who just operates in that world. But the fact is that this is a different world, different skill set. And, you know, my personal skill set of having experience doing things people have no experience doing is a perfect fit for this, because we can go out there and figure out how to get something done in a very strange environment and be the first ones to do the things that we're doing.
Well, and Bob, as you mentioned, there's something special about getting to do something in your hometown, getting to build a business in your own backyard. And I want to talk a little bit about what you are building in California, because it's very special and very interesting to chart the growth of Glasshouse Farms over the last couple of years. And I saw a quote from you somewhere where you talked about building a craft brand at scale, and you referenced Lagunitas. And I thought that was a great analogy. And of course, Bob, as we've been talking recently about Amazon's interest in the space, looking at what that market for cannabis products will look like in the near future, and that there will be space for both the craft market and the quote-unquote Budweisers of cannabis. But Graham, you mentioned that interstate commerce is one of the topics that's been on your mind lately, and I'm interested, particularly because of your location there on the West Coast and, you know, your neighbors to the north and east. What do you see as some of the major issues behind the topic of interstate commerce?
So, I mean, I think interstate commerce is really interesting. My personal opinion is that it's an inevitability. Certainly, you know, you can have other views. I like to think about it as kind of go back to first principles, which is either cannabis is like every other product in our country's history, and then it moves around state to state, or it is the single exception, and it is going to be the equivalent of when you go to Wyoming, you pick your favorite Wyoming wine, and when you go to New York, you pick your favorite New York wine. My opinion is that champagne comes from France, tequila comes from Mexico, cannabis comes from California. When you go places, you don't drink Ohio wine, you drink Napa wine, you drink French wine. You probably don't have a favorite non-Mexican tequila brand, right? To me, it seems like it has to go that direction. I think Congress will do it, maybe slower than some people were thinking. But if Congress doesn't do it, I think the courts do it. I think that the Dormant Commerce Clause of the Constitution guarantees, I mean, this is a quote basically, that for American farmers, their market is the entire country. And if that doesn't apply to cannabis, I don't know what they meant. You can see early precedents being set in this when states have tried to have residency laws for cannabis permits, right? I mean, a residency law, if you're not from Massachusetts, you can't get a Massachusetts cannabis license. That is, in effect, disadvantaging non-Massachusetts residents versus Massachusetts residents. That's what the Dormant Commerce Clause doesn't allow you to do. When those residency laws get challenged, they've been dropped every time. I mean, you can even see I think it was in Michigan, that it was stayed by a federal judge, right? So now you have the federal government saying, we're not going to allow you to implement this because it violates the Dormant Commerce Clause, because it preferentially treats your local residents versus residents of other states. So I think if Congress doesn't do it, as soon as somebody challenges it, it's going to happen. And I also think that consumers eventually get what they want. And you can see what they want, which is California cannabis across the country. I mean, to the point that I had somebody visiting here in Santa Barbara who's from a legal cannabis state, yet they were stocking up to smuggle California cannabis from a dispensary here back home, right? Like, they were smuggling California cannabis into a legal state, right? That tells you how bad people want. If you go to New York, you look through the bodegas, you look at the secret menu, Florida would be closer. You know, you guys in Colorado have been doing it longer than us, yet it's not filled with those brands. It's filled with California brands because that's what consumers want. And I think the Constitution supports them.
Well, no, you're spot on. In fact, I've done a lot of work in Mexico on their legislation from a policy perspective. And there are underground dispensaries in Mexico City that I've been invited to tour. And I've been to probably a dozen of them. And nearly every single one is replete with California cannabis products. Now, you and I both know there's legal challenges to that. No companies that I would mention in this forum, but I would tell you that the desire for cannabis products from the state of California remains at an all-time high, and for good reason, because of the legacy, so forth and so on. But, you know, when you go to law school, you learn about constitutional law, and there are esoteric constitutional scholars that I go out to lunch with periodically. And to your point about the Dormant Commerce Clause, these scholars, these folks that know constitutional law inside and out, are adamant that a decision from the Supreme Court, particularly from conservative jurists as we've got right now, would have to go in favor of the states, which would open up that marketplace dramatically, although unfortunately our court system does move quite slowly. So in the absence of judicial relief, do you think the Biden administration, which almost weekly sends us mixed signals about its its impression of the cannabis industry, do you think the Biden administration does that? And not to create a compound question that's even more complex, but how does Amazon and Uber and Scott's Miracle-Gro and Constellation Brands, in other words, large companies, how do they play into the influence there?
Yeah, I don't think that Biden is a huge fan of cannabis. I think he's got personal reasons that make him resistant to it. I think if something ended up on his desk, he would, for political reasons, almost be forced to sign it because he couldn't go on record not signing it, particularly because it most likely would come from a social justice point of view, which, you know, for the record, I think is frankly more urgent and more important than the business point of view. If there was an option to put my, you know, business interest in interstate and, you know, federal legalization aside to move the social justice side of legalization faster, I would raise my hand and take that. I mean, I think that the war on drugs was never really a war on drugs. I think it was a war on people. I think it's specifically, it was a war on specific people at that. I think it's been an utter failure and from a public health point of view, but a tremendous success if your goal was to put certain people in jail and massive numbers and create a commercial prison complex that tore apart certain communities. And I think that that needs to end and can't end soon enough. So I think he would have to sign it for those very good reasons. But I think politically he will discourage it from landing on his desk. Clearly we know what Chuck Schumer wants to do, and he needs to get a certain number of votes for that to happen. And I'm not sure that there's the political capital for that, at least right now. But I do think that the less likely that is, perhaps the more likely an expanded safe banking is. And I think that there's a lot of value to that, and that the odds of that happening probably get higher by the day. And that would do a bunch of great things for the industry, you know, 280E and a bunch of tax stuff. So it's an inevitability. It's a fool's errand to try and judge a political timing. If you ask me to be a fool, I would say that my guess is it's probably 2 to 3 years out, which is great timing, I think, from us and where we sit in Glasshouse. And I think that we'll continue to see the progress and the safe banking, or especially expanded safe banking, listing on U.S. exchanges, 280E tax removal. full banking, not just bank accounts, but true banking for cannabis would be, you know, massively beneficial for the industry. And many of those companies that you mentioned would have a much clearer path to do what they clearly want to do, which is play in the space if that happens.
That's very well said. You know, I've served in a top executive position in several MSOs over the last several years, and the luck of being a interim CEO of a botanical extractor that was a multinational company and expanding their operations globally. I understand the challenges in this space, even in legal jurisdictions. As you embark on sort of building out Glasshouse and looking at ambitious plans, I'm sure, what are some of the objectives and correspondingly the challenges that you expect over the coming years?
Gee, that's a good question. Crystal ball to that. I think cannabis is interesting because it's the definition of a frontier market from the point of view that many of the things that are so taken for granted that you don't even notice them in other industries are significant friction, hurdles, accomplishments, you know, whatever the right word is. We're just talking safe banking, right? Like in no other industry would getting a bank account be on your business plan, right? Like you wouldn't, you know, what's one of my goals for this, you know, year, right? Get a bank account. Like that'd be a Tuesday morning, right? And here in cannabis, we are thankful to have banking for all of our operations. We had a celebratory dinner when we got bank accounts, right? And we had a second dinner when we got a regular bank account where we didn't have to pay money to deposit our cash, right? Like those things, you can talk about insurance. You can talk about who's willing to do your paychecks. You can talk about credit lines. You can talk about, you know, employees you can hire and their concern over immigration status to work in the industry, right? Like those multitude of small but significant and compounding frictions. And then, of course, the stigma out there, right? And the fact that every time we want to build a, you know, new building for processing, some anti-cannabis prohibition person spends the $500 to appeal it and talk about how we're trying to turn Santa Barbara into a narco state. You know, it's like that kind of stuff is, it's just, you know, those are the things that there's these external, it's like riding your bike with the brakes stuck halfway on sometimes. So, you know, again, I think it's a challenge and the opportunity, right? Like if it was easy, someone would have already done it. I wouldn't go into competition with somebody and growing corn or tomatoes because like there's people who are very, very good at that. We have the opportunity because of all those frictions and because, you know, other people's concerns over being in this market to be the one who gets to be that good. And so, you know, I try not to complain about it because if it wasn't for those things, we probably wouldn't have a chance to be here.
Well, and that's kind of the point, right? When we celebrate your entrepreneurial spirit, which is a common thread that we see in a lot of the folks that we speak with on this podcast, that there are a lot of challenges in this industry, but the potential and the possibilities that the future hold are what drive all of us and what we're so passionate about. And before we let you go, Graham, I just want to give you the opportunity to highlight anything for our listeners, any other engagements or products coming out or anything you just want to highlight before we sign off.
Yeah, for those, you know, outside of California who might not know it, glasshousegroup.com is our website. Glasshousefarms.org is our product page. You know, if you're in California, we've got four dispensaries now in the process of opening 17 more. Those are under the pharmacy brand. So certainly come check us out. Glasshouse Farms is our premier, kind of our primary brand on the flower side. We have an awesome brand that we developed with Bella Thorne, which is really cool and, you know, kind of female focused and very much a Bella approach, which I think is unique. And the target and who it's made for is that kind of 21 plus female called Forbidden Flowers. We have a brand that's a connoisseur extract brand called Field, all fresh frozen, live resin, live rosins. I'm Graham Ferrar on Twitter if you want to hear things that I have to say. So, you know, I think that, you know, reach out and connect with us. And we're excited to get to know a whole new group of people as part of this process of going public with the Mercer Park Brand SPAC that's happening here in the next couple of weeks. So, you know, we'd love to get to know some new people and come visit us as soon as you can.
Oh, we can't wait to keep following your journey. And thank you so much, Graham, for taking the time to be with us here on the Hoban Minute today. Take care, sir.
Awesome. Yeah, pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.